In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful, thank you very much for coming here tonight. It's been a while since the last time that I visited the center. The topic of tonight's presentation is the role of prayer in the spiritual life. I had a presentation here a couple of years ago on mystical prayer. The youth group at the center asked me to do a follow-up with that lecture. Let me start with the highlights of my previous lecture on mystical prayer. Prayer is a very important part and component of all world religions, all spiritual traditions. The specifics, the mechanics, and the forms of prayers obviously vary from one religion to the next. However, all world religions, with no exception, recognize the central role that prayer plays in spiritual growth and development of the individuals. Mystics such as Rumi teach us that prayer is not a monologue. Prayer is a dialogue. It's a two-way communication between the worshiper and God. And more importantly, this dialogue does not get started with the worshiper. It is God that initiates the dialogue. I guess Rumi himself said it best in the following poem. As it is my way of doing business here, I usually recite the original poem in Farsi, the original language, and then I will translate it into English. جست و پیش کی برآرد بنده دست هم دعا و هم اجابت از تو است هم از اول تو دهی میل دعا تو دهی آخر دعاها را گزا اول و آخر تو ایما در میان هیچ هیچی که نیاید در بیان To whom but you should your servant lift his hand Both the prayer and the answer to prayer are from you. You at first give the desire for prayer, and you at last likewise give the recompense for prayer. You are the first and the last. We between are nothing, a nothing that does not come into admit of expression. In other words, prayer starts with God and it ends up with God. Now, when the worshiper accepts God's invitation for a loving relationship, that acceptance takes the form of prayer. So, in a sense, when we pray, we are just accepting God's invitation. We are saying yes to God's invitation to establish a loving relationship according to Rumi. The next point. Prayers obviously come in all shapes, forms, and sizes. But we can broadly classify all prayers into two categories, as I mentioned before. We have formal prayers and informal prayers. By definition, informal prayers mean that they are not scripted. They are not structured. They are basically the compositions of the worshiper himself or herself. Such informal prayers might be recited out loud or silently. They may be whispered. They can be in the form of a simple Hello God, or thank you God, or they may involve asking God for favors. Furthermore, they can be even expression of our deepest concerns and our deepest existential fears. We all have those kind of fears, especially when we look death eye to eye. So that's what basically informal prayer is all about. These prayers are the compositions of the worshiper herself. Now, my previous lecture mostly dealt with informal prayers. formal prayers, as the name implies, they are structured. They are scripted. They are supposed to be done exactly the same way every single time. So there is not to be any variation in the way those prayers are done. And typically, these formal prayers consist of reciting some words and possibly some body movements. All religions, again, have formal prayers with almost no exception. Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, they all invariably have formal prayers. Let me give you a couple of examples. In Judaism, one of the formal prayers is Shema. Shema is a prayer that is typically done in public during the morning and evening prayers. Certain passages from the Torah are selected, and those passages have to do with the tenets of Jewish faith. So the principles of the Jewish faith are reminded to the congregation every time Shema is conducted. Catholics obviously have a lot of formal prayers as well. The Catholics in the audience probably know about the sign of the cross or the Apostles' Creed. There are a lot of them. In the Islamic tradition, probably the most important and talked about formal prayer is Salah, or daily prayers that Muslims do, interestingly enough, five times a day. Before the sunrise, at noon, mid-afternoon, after the sunset, and evening. Five times a day, exactly the same passages, exactly the same kind of body movements. This lecture tonight is primarily about these formal prayers, as I mentioned. Let me pose a rhetorical question off the bat. Why do we have formal prayers in Catholicism, in Judaism, in Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism? What functions do these formal prayers fulfill? What goals do they achieve for the faithful? The ideas that I will share with you tonight apply equally to all world religions. The logic, the reasoning that I offer to you, you can easily apply to all of them. I will use examples from Christianity and Islam just to illustrate. Let me spend a few minutes and talk about the proper role of not just prayers, but religious practices in general. Why do we have these religious practices? There has been an age-old debate in all religious circles on the necessity of religious practices and prayers for spirituality and faith. How do these religious practices that these religions have assist somebody to get closer to God, to love God more, to have a deeper faith? Right? How does that happen? Obviously, all religions have rites, rituals, observances, and prayers. For example, all Abrahamic traditions have some form of fasting, every one of them. Every one of them has some type of a pilgrimage to holy sites. They all have a requirement for the faithful to pay a portion of their wealth for charity. They also have formal ceremonies for marriage. In most of these religions, there are also dietary guidelines as a requirement of faith. And as I mentioned, there are also prayers such as Salah or Shema. The common question is this: what do these practices and prayers have anything to do with faith? I get this question all the time, especially from the youth. How does my act of prayer or conducting my marriage ceremony in a certain way, how does it make me love God more? How does it help me get closer to God? How does it happen? Let me spend a few minutes talking about this issue. At their core, all world religions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, all of them with no exception, they are here to inspire their followers to seek a dimension of existence that lies beyond the sensual world. They are here to invite their followers to seek a different dimension of existence that lies beyond the material world. If you ask me, what is the cornerstone of the mission of these religions, that's what I would offer you. To get connected to the source from which all existence originated. Now, obviously, once the followers embark on this journey to get connection to the unseen, so to speak, to that dimension of existence that is unseen to us, as soon as we start walking on down that path, we will have experiences, spiritual experiences. Prophets, messengers of God, and mystics, they are all champions and forerunners in this arena, in the arena of spiritual experiences. Abraham, Noah, Moses, Isaiah, Muhammad, Jesus, they all had deep spiritual experiences. They were not stingy, by the way. They shared those experiences with us. They encouraged us to follow their footsteps so we can repeat those experiences and benefit from them. And I might add, at the risk of being misunderstood, to build upon what they had accomplished. Now, let me give you a couple of these examples. Examples of deep spiritual experiences that prophets of God and messengers of God had. Again, I'm trying to elaborate why we have religious practices and prayers, right? We're going to get there in a sec. For now, let's talk about spiritual experiences. A couple of quick examples of spiritual experiences that these prophets and messengers of God had. The first one in Arabic or in the Quranic terminology is called khashyah, or in English, awe. This experience is when the person finds himself in the presence of a reality which is ineffable. The person feels engulfed by the greatness, by the infiniteness and majesty of God. I believe this passage from the book of Psalm in the Holy Bible says it the best. This is an example of khashyah or awe. Listen carefully to this passage. The Lord merely spoke, and the heavens were created. He breathed the word, and all the stars were born. He gave the sea its boundaries and locked the oceans in vast reservoirs. Let everyone in the world fear the Lord, and let everyone stand in awe of him. If you notice, the passage starts with the story of creation and how awesome and how majestic the act of creation was. And then the person is standing in awe when comprehends and realizes the magnitude of the majesty of the Creator. If you guys want to picture the wisdom in this passage from the book of Psalms, I invite you to go to the Hubble website tonight after you go home. How many of you have visited the website? You know what I'm talking about. Look at their picture gallery. Those little dots of light that you see in those pictures are not stars. They are whole galaxies made of billions or millions of stars. That's the wisdom that this passage from the Holy Bible is teaching us, that sense of awe. The experience of awe led the prophets to have a profound reverence, a profound respect for God. Their hearts would tremble after they fully comprehended the awesomeness of God. And because of that experience, they would be truly humble. You see, for people like me, humble is just an utterance of speech. It's different when you experience it in the presence of a very majestic entity. Let me give you another experience that all the prophets and messengers of God had, and that's the experience of trust, or in the Quranic terminology, tawakkul. For most of us, trust in God is an ethical virtue. Well, ethical virtue is one thing, but an existential, a spiritual experience is something totally different. See, a lot of us, either we are brainwashed, if you want to look at it negatively, or if you want to look at it from positive perspective, we are given good reasons why we should have trust in God. This is not the way messengers and prophets of God came to have trust in God. It wasn't by philosophical discourse. It was through first-hand personal experience. Let me share with you the story of Moses and his followers as an example for trusting God. Again, all prophets of God had some sort of an experience when they faced seemingly insurmountable obstacles. Moses had that experience firsthand when he asked the Hebrew folks to escape from bondage in Egypt. So on their trail, they had the army of Pharaoh, and what was in front of them? A river, according to the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic tradition. Can you picture that? No way out. At some point in our lives, we have been in those kind of predicaments. No way out. We feel like we have reached a stalemate in life. We cannot escape from the predicament that has befallen us. Well, Moses had full trust in the willingness and the ability of God to intervene. Not only God is able to save, but he is willing to do that. Moses did not waver in the face of such adversity. He did not abandon his faith just because of the sheer magnitude of the obstacle. Well, he persevered, his followers persevered, and ultimately God saved them. This is an experience. This is not something that a philosopher would get up and convince you of its accuracy. It's something that you would experience, touch, and feel firsthand. Well, all of these spiritual experiences that we might have, they are like a pearl. A pearl needs a shell to be protected. Or I could use the example of a newborn infant. As soon as the baby is born, what do with the baby? We wrap the baby in some kind of a cloth so that he stays warm and healthy. Prophets of God also had a newborn. What was that newborn? These sort of spiritual experiences. They had to protect the outcome of these experiences. So they wove an intricate shell around the faith they had acquired in God. They wove an intricate shell around the spiritual experiences that they had. How did they do it? What was the fabric of that shell? By a couple of protective layers. So what were those two fabrics out of which these messengers of God created a shell to protect their faith and their experiences? Let me explain for a couple of minutes. The first protective layer, or the safety belt, is ethical and moral codes of conduct. I don't know whether you've ever thought about morality in that sense or not, but that's exactly what it is. Now, morality taught by a philosophy professor is very different than morality the way it's taught in religion. In religious traditions, morality was a safety belt, a cloth that would wrap the faith and the spiritual experiences. Don't lie. Don't transgress. Help the needy. Be compassionate. These are examples of moral codes of conduct. Now, a moral lifestyle, does wonders, does magic to cleanse the individual of all sorts of evil. Evils of the heart, of the mind, and evil in deeds. This is a great way for doing, quote-unquote, self-cleansing. This is the fundamental role of ethics in all religious traditions. You see, ethical lifestyle creates a fertile ground for deeper spiritual experiences, create a fertile ground for a deeper connection with God and deeper faith. In turn, deeper faith facilitates ethical conduct. So there is reciprocity here. It's give and take here. Are you following me? So, that was the very first protective layer that the messengers and prophets of God came up with in order to protect their faith. The second protective layer was actually the subject of our discussion tonight. Religious practices and prayers, rites, rituals, observances, so on and so forth. I think Rumi does a great job when he uses the example of walnut to elaborate and explain this second protective layer of faith. A walnut has a very thick shell, right? Inside that thick shell lies a very soft kernel. Religious practices, according to Rumi, are this thick shell. Faith and spiritual experiences are the kernel. Just as the walnut kernel needs a shell to protect it, faith and spirituality also require a shell in order to endure and persist. In the real world, I submit to you, you will never ever find a walnut kernel on a tree. Have you ever seen one? It's impossible. You will always find a walnut kernel wrapped inside a shell. If there is to be a kernel at all, it must exist within this thick shell. Unfortunately, some religious folks in every community, they buy walnuts, they crack them, they take the kernel and throw it away, and they eat the shell. Have you come across those folks? They eat the shell. What do we call these folks? Formalists. These are guys and gals who celebrate the shell. They are oblivious to the fact that there is a kernel beyond the shell, right? These are the religious formalists. These are the guys and gals who are obsessed with religious practices and dogma, with not much regard for faith, spirituality, love, mercy, so on and so forth. Well, on the other side of the coin, we also find folks who wish to have a walnut without a shell. These are the folks who do not want to do prayers. They do not want to do the religious practices. And I'm sure you've come across these folks that who always say that what is important is a clean heart. What is important for me is to have a clean heart. I love God. What else do you want from me? Well, I submit to you, and I don't want to judge necessarily, so I make it very general. For most of these sort of folks, faith, love, mercy, and all of that are nothing but cheap talk with no substance. Well, according to Rumi, we need to properly understand the role of religious practices as the second layer, second protective layer for our faith. Rumi correctly points out that the shell fulfills two functions and services simultaneously. The shell can function as a mask for the kernel. What happens when it becomes a mask? We do not see the kernel inside. That is the improper function of a shell, right? But on the other hand, the shell can also serve as a protective layer to protect the kernel. That is the proper function of the shell. Let me make a quick point here. Just because prayers and other religious practices are called the shell, it does not mean that they are not important. Because that's the false conclusion to make from what Rumi has to say. Because a lot of folks would say, well, if it's a shell, it means it's unimportant. The kernel is important. One more time. Without the shell, the kernel is not going to survive. The shell has a very important function to satisfy in spiritual traditions. The bottom line is this. Love of God, faith, mercy, a good and pure heart, they are no substitute for prayers. They do not replace religious practices. They complement prayers. They complement religious practices. All of them together combined, love, mercy, good heart, combined with religious practices, create a whole and complete spiritual life. They always should go hand in hand. Prayers and religious practices keep God's remembrance alive in our heart and our mind. They keep the love of God very vibrant in our daily lives. That's the function, that's the proper role of prayers. Let me delve a little bit deeper into this question of the association between prayers and faith. How does prayer assist our faith? I've said it before and let me say it again. The jewel of religion is faith. The jewel of religion is faith. But we should not confuse faith with dogma. That's a common mistake we all make. We should not confuse faith with dogma. We should not confuse faith with belief in certain theological doctrines. Doctrines are nothing but theological formulations. They are theories. They are important. They satisfy an important function. But they should never be confused with the essence of faith. The essence of faith is a relationship. The essence of faith is a relationship, a deep relationship with God. Prayer is also about relationship, isn't it? Because prayer takes place between two parties that have a relationship in place, right? There has to be already a relationship between the worshiper and God before that communication can be established and take place. So think of prayer as also a relationship. Here's the catch though. All relationships require maintenance. Whether they are emotional, marital, behavioral, or spiritual. Any relationship requires maintenance. Any relationship requires nourishment. If we do not nourish a relationship, that relationship cannot flourish. I guess we can all, married folks in the audience would say amen, right? We need to nourish a relationship, even if that relationship is with God, in order for it to flourish. This is another controversial point that I would like to make here. Faith, by definition and by its very essence, is transient. It's not a fixture. It's not like you either have it or you don't. Faith is not a fixture. Faith will always be in a flux, very similar to a relationship. Think of faith as being in a relationship. Our relationship with God is also subject to ups and downs, right? What happened when we face a downturn in our relationship with God? What do we call that? Weakness of faith. That's when our faith gets weak. On the upside, we call it the strength of faith. True faith is always like this. Even messengers of God were like that. Read the Quran carefully. There are times that even messengers and prophets of God, their faith would be shaken. Negative experiences in life shake the foundation of our faith in God. They make us question whether God will deliver on His promises of saving us, right? That's what true faith is all about. It is subject to be shaken. Even more, faith in God is prone to complete disruption. Let me make a quick point. I hate not to say that. Those folks who abandon their religious faith, it's not because somebody gave them a new book on philosophy of religion and now they're convinced God does not exist. It's because they've had some sort of a negative experience that shook the foundation of their faith in God, in God's deliverance. That's typically what happens. Again, we need to flourish our relationship with God. We need to have fuel for our faith, some kind of spiritual energy. Daily prayers are specifically designed to provide spiritual energy. Those daily prayers are basically here to nourish our faith in God, to strengthen the bond between us and God. The more you do them, the more energy will get generated in order to sustain your journey towards God. Now let me get a bit deeper than that when it comes to the association of faith and prayer. Let me talk about the relationship between prayer and remembrance of God. As I mentioned, that's an important aspect of formal prayers. I guess we can all agree that our fast-paced modern lifestyles certainly create a very unfavorable environment for spirituality, very unfavorable environment for spiritual living. One of the victims of our busyness, our being busy, having a very hectic schedule and on-the-go lifestyle, is prayer. Many of us feel like we just do not have enough time to pray during the day. This is a common complaint of especially younger religious folks. Just imagine for a sec, a young Muslim having to pray 5 times a day while working in the corporate world. For many of us, it becomes very difficult to maintain. Frankly, some of us might prefer to pray at our own convenience, whenever we have some spare time to do our prayers. Many of us have that kind of a feeling. Well, I've got news for you if you are one of them. Spirituality was never meant to be an adjunct to life. Faith was never meant to be a supplement to life. Going to church or mosque or synagogue whenever we just have time to do it. It's never been about that. But unfortunately for many of us, faith and spirituality takes a backseat to our job, our profession, our other relationships, to entertainment, and God knows what other preoccupations we have. When in fact, religion, faith, and spirituality was about a lifestyle. Spirituality is a lifestyle. It's a way of life that is centered on God. A life in which God shapes the values, inspirations, aspirations, and the daily choices that we make in life. That's what religion truly was all about from day one. It was about life choices that we have to make day in and day out. Now here obviously I'm not implying that the spiritual life requires that we become a monk. That's not what I am saying by any stretch of imagination. It simply means being so captivated with the beauty of the divine that we do not crave for anything else. If that happens, then God will become the focal point of your life. You see, we must be captivated by a beauty, according to Rumi, if we want that beauty to dictate the course of our life. Isn't that what love is all about? That's how that beauty will shape our values, priorities, and inspirations. I guess Rumi said it best after he had a first-hand glimpse at the beauty of the divine. After he had a glimpse of the beauty of God, he came up with this beautiful poetry. کاش کی از غیر تو آگه نبودی جان من خود ندانستی به جز تو جان معنی دان من غیر رویت هر چه بینم نور چشمم کم شود هر کسی را رحمت ای پرده مژگان من I wish my soul was aware of none but you. Here obviously he's talking to God. I wish my soul was aware of none but you. My soul knew of nothing but you. Besides your face, anything I see dims my vision. Oh, my eyelids, do not let just anyone in. You see, he's saying, I wish I could see nothing in life but the beauty of the divine. And he's instructing his eyelids to be shut if the eyes are about to look at anything but the beauty of the beloved. You see, prayer should ideally be about a craving for God, a craving that emanates from the depth of our soul. It is not something that should be done in our spare time. If I were to use the analogy of a wheel, I would say the following. Prayer is not a spare wheel, but a steering wheel. It is supposed to steer the course of our lives. Having said that, yes, true, this is the ideal situation as far as prayers is concerned. But effectively speaking, we mortals suffer from a chronic problem in the daily chore of life. You know what that is? Forgetfulness. In our busy life and hectic daily schedule, we typically forget God. Now, by forgetting God, I don't mean that we forget that God is high up there somewhere. That if somebody asked me, who is your creator, I would forget, oh, was it my dad or was it God? This is not what I mean. What I mean by forgetting God is God as a metaphor for our values. God as a metaphor for our aspirations and direction in life. God as the sanctuary in this uncertain and fragile life. That's what we tend to forget. And when we forget God, which we often do, we get lost. And when we get lost, and invariably we all get lost, we need to have some kind of a compass to show us the direction back to our sanctuary. A compass that will show us the way back home to God. And that compass, by the way, is our daily prayers. Daily prayers are essentially a compass to find our sanctuary, a reminder of what our values, goals in life should be. Invariably, in that sense, all world religions, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, so on and so forth, all world religions have formal prayers that encapsulate important teachings and important messages. Those teachings, those messages must be reinforced on a daily basis. Those messages ought to be reminded to us regularly. And that is basically the essential function of daily prayers. And the question is this. When Muslims stand in front of God towards Kaaba and they recite certain words and passages, do these words and passages have any impact on them? When Catholics and Jews recite their daily and nightly prayers, do they really have any impact on the worshipper? Well, from the field of psychology, we know that words have very powerful impact on us. But for that to happen, for that impact to take place, it is necessary that the words we utter in prayer are fully understood. The meaning of those words ought to be fully comprehended. The context in which those words and passages are recited must be understood. Prayer has a very deep connection with the mind. Very deep connection. The mind ought to be really involved in prayer. When the mind understands the meaning behind the words that we say, when the mind understands the body movements we make in prayer, then the mind can actively participate in the prayer. So the mental cognitive connection must be established before we can have fruitful prayer. Well, this is just theory. So far, everything I've told you, that prayers, the words that we recite in prayers, have an impact or can have an impact on us, is just theory. Let me give you a concrete example, a real-world example of a daily prayer that if we truly understand what it means, it can have a profound transformative impact on us. Here, let me share with you the example of Salat, or daily prayer, in the Islamic tradition. For those of you who are not Muslims in the audience, the Islamic daily prayer consists of units, 2, 3, or 4. Each unit typically involves a short chapter from the Quran, and most Muslims recite the very first chapter in the Quran, which is very short, and it only has 7 verses in it in every unit of their daily prayer. Let me tell you what those verses are, and I will give you some kind of a commentary on those verses. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. So that's how the prayer is started. Again, this is supposed to be a reminder to us what kind of a Lord we are dealing with. A Lord that is most gracious, most merciful. You see, in the Abrahamic tradition, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism included, God has 2 types of mercy. The first type of mercy of God, Ar-Rahman, in this chapter, has to do with universal mercy of God. This is the mercy that is absolute and it is unconditional. This type of mercy of God is directed equally at all His creation, without any regard to the worth. In other words, this type of universal mercy of God doesn't discriminate. Doesn't say, oh, Joe is an atheist, so I'm not going to have mercy towards him. Right? It is irrespective of worth. In the Christian theology, what do we call this type of mercy of God? Grace. That's what grace is all about. The second type of mercy of God is conditional, right? It is conditional. It is based on reciprocity. The more we can absorb, the more God will give. So it depends on us. The more we become worthy, the more our capacity grows, the more we can receive that type of mercy of God. That's what we are reminding ourselves in our daily prayers. The second verse, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Praise belongs to God, Lord of the universe. What are we saying here? Praise belongs to Lord. Only God, the ruler of the universe, deserves unconditional praise and admiration. Is that how we faithful actually live every day? I submit to you, we don't. Only God deserves unconditional admiration. It basically means that we should give God the due respect and honor that He truly deserves. How can we honor God the way He actually deserves it? I submit to you that we can do it by our thoughts, by our intentions, and our deeds. But mostly, we can honor God by squarely placing God in the middle of our lives, where He should truly be. That's what we essentially say and remind ourselves when we say, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Praise belongs to God. This is, by the way, a reminder to us that only the things that have the color of God are worthy of admiration. This is a reminder to us that only the things that have the mark of God deserves our affection and our following. Now, what sort of Lord of the universe is He? Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Praise be to the Lord of the universe. What kind of Lord is He for this universe? The following verse tells us, Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim. Again, most gracious, most merciful. He governs this vast universe based on His mercy. We can count on His mercy. His mercy flows through not only His creation, but also the way He manages the affairs of His creation and the universe day in and day out. Now we are reminding ourselves that when we hit major obstacles in life, we can count on the mercy of God. That's how He manages the business of the universe. Malik Yawmiddin, master of the day of judgment. The day of judgment means the future. God not only reigns in the present time, He also reigns in the future. The future also belongs to our Lord. إِيَّاكَ نَعْبُدُ وَإِيَّاكَ نَسْتَعِينَ. It is You alone we submit to. It is You alone we ask for help. How can we submit to God in a meaningful way? That's the question. We just keep saying it every time, every day. How can we do it in a meaningful way? إِيَّاكَ نَعْبُدُ. It is You alone that we submit. True submission and true obedience in Arabic is called ibadat, which is the root word of na'bud. What does ibadah or absolute obedience mean? In Arabic, which is very insightful by the way, ibadat, absolute obedience, means to level one's existence in such a way that it becomes receptive to the message of God. We shape our existence in such a way that it becomes receptive to the commandments of God. In other words, we become a fertile ground to accept the values that God offers for our life. It's only then that we can have meaningful submission of God. Otherwise, this submission is nothing but an expression of the tongue, and I submit to you that's what we do day in and day out. And then, إِيَّاكَ نَسْتَعِينَ. It is You alone we ask for help. What does it mean, we ask only You for help? What does it mean in real life, in our daily chore of life? It means we will not bow to anyone to receive favors. Is that how we live? We will not bow to anyone in the office, at school, at home, in order to receive favors. That's what we are saying in our daily prayer. We will not cozy up. We will not butter up anyone in the hope of advancing our own needs. We will never sell ourselves cheap. And I submit to you, unfortunately, especially in the modern world, that we do day in and day out. We sell ourselves cheap. Well, this verse also means that we will have integrity. We will have immense self-worth and self-respect. It also means that we will not put any individual, we will not put any government in the position of being our provider. Because only God truly provides. Governments, human beings are nothing but instruments in the service of God to provide for His creation. Again, this is what we are reminding ourselves, at least as Muslims, 10 times a day. And I submit to you, as soon as we finish our prayer, we forget it. That's the challenge. So that's what daily prayers are all about. Constant reminder, because we are always at the risk of forgetting the most important things as far as our faith is concerned. And now we offer our wish list to God. The favors we are asking God. This is absolutely astonishing. Not about having a good job, the most gorgeous looking spouse, none of that. اِحْدِنَا الصِّرَاطَ الْمُسْتَقِيمِ O God, guide us to the straight path. That is the favor we're asking for. Guide us to the straight path. You see, guide, especially in Arabic, is someone that assists in a journey. The guide walks in front and everybody else follows. Now we are asking God to be our guide in the journey of life. God, make us worthy of following you. Enable us to walk with you. Put us on your path, a path that takes us directly to you. Which path is it? What is that straight path? That is our next on the wish list. صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. The path of those you have blessed. The path of those you have blessed. Those who incur no anger, who have not gone astray. Lead us to the path of those that you have blessed. Well, God has blessed all His creation. Here, that's not what we mean. We are not talking about His universal blessing. We are talking about people that God has specially blessed. Who are those folks? Abraham, Moses, Isaiah, Jesus, Muhammad. These are the people that we hope God will guide us to follow in their footsteps. We want to be just like them. We want to live like them. That is our wish. That's what we are asking God to enable us to do. غَيْرِ الْمَغْضُوبِ عَلَيْهِمْ Not those who incur any anger from God. We don't want to walk on the path of those whom incited God's wrath because of the horrible deeds they made or because of their mischief. We don't want to be like them. وَلَا الظَّالِينَ And not those who have gone astray. We don't want to walk on the path of those who have lost their way. Younger folks in the audience, watch who your idols are. American Idol, we see it all the time on TV, right? That's basically what we are reminding ourselves. God, help us not to follow those who are misguided. When we want to choose a right model, we want that role model to be Jesus. We want that role model to be Isaiah. We want that role model to be Abraham. These are the role models that, oh God, enable us to effectively have in our lives. Muslims, again, repeat this short list at least 10 times a day, and I submit to you that we just do not have the presence of mind and heart to follow through with them. I know that it's getting late, but let me give you two other episodes of the daily prayers because that's a common in all Abrahamic traditions. Another episode of the daily prayer is bowing. After Muslims recite their prayers, they bow to God. And they say, Subhan Rabbi al-Azim wa bihamdih. Glory and praise be to the Lord, most great. What does it mean? What is the significance of bowing to God? Are we just stretching? It is a form of yoga? What is it that we're doing? Well, it is very important. If we do not understand the meaning of bowing, the mind cannot participate in the prayer. What does bowing signify? Brothers and sisters, when you bow, essentially you break yourself. You are breaking yourself. This breakage is not for humiliation. It is for transformation. You break yourself not as a sign of being humiliated, but as a sign of a wish to be transformed. I guess Rumi said it the best with the analogy of a jug. ای به غیرت بر سبو سنگی زده وان سبو اشکست کامل تر شده خم شکسته آب از او ناریخته صد درستی زین شکستن ریخته. I don't think you can say it any better than this. Oh, you who from jealousy has hurled a stone at the jug, while the jug has become more perfect through being shattered. The jar is shattered, but the water is not spilled from it. From this shattering have arisen 100 soundnesses. Can you picture this? That when you shatter a jar or a jug, no water is spilled from that? This is a paradox, isn't it? When we bow, what is it that we're shattering? We are not shattering our existence. We are shattering our illusions. The illusion that we can attain happiness, we can attain fulfillment and perfection by immersing ourselves in materialism, by immersing in ourselves in our jobs and becoming workaholic. Isn't that amazing? That we, the faithful, a lot of us are workaholics. Well, that is what we are supposed to be shattering when we bow. We want to shatter off illusions of happiness. The illusion that we can achieve happiness and fulfillment and we can have accomplishment by bowing to false gods and false idols that are man-made. You see, there is one place that we can rightfully permit ourselves to break, and that's only in the presence of God. A God who is all-loving and merciful. A God that is not abusive. A God that does not need us to get richer. A God who doesn't need us in order to become more powerful. God is all-powerful as He is. When we break, we do not make God more powerful. Our breaking basically empower us to become more perfect. When we bow to God, it means we will not bow to anybody who is lower than Him. That's what it means. We will never bow to anybody who is lower than God. Well, this is very liberating, isn't it? When you do not bow to anybody who is lower than God. That's why God will set us free. God will set us free from other creatures, other human beings. God will even set us free from our own attachments. Again, this is a paradox, to submit and be free. Submission and freedom, it's a paradox, isn't it? Because typically, when we submit, it is as if we are in bondage, isn't it? But here, according to Rumi, this is a paradox. We submit, but at the same time, we are set free. I guess Hafiz, another Persian Muslim mystic, said it the best when he said, من از آن روز که در بند تو ام آزادم. I have been free from the day that I bonded with you. So essentially, this is the function of bowing in all Abrahamic traditions, in Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. The last thing that I want to share with you, the last episode of the daily prayers that is very meaningful, very empowering if we truly understand what it means, and that is prostration. Well, Muslims prostrate during the daily prayers and they say, Subhana Rabbi al-A'la wa bihamdih, glory and praise be to the Lord, Most High. See, prostration is a very important practice in the Abrahamic tradition. What is the significance of that? You see, the great hurdle in faith, the great hurdle in accepting God and the truth is our arrogance, is our pride. That's what makes us unable to embrace the truth, to embrace God and embrace faith. The arrogant person does not see a need for divine revelation, for divine assistance, because he is too proud to look at the mirror and see his own shortcomings. Well, there is no hope for salvation, for embracing God, unless we beat down on our pride and arrogance. We cannot submit to God, to his designs, unless we are truly humble. That's the only time we can truly embrace God. Well, prostration is the great sign of humility in front of God. In my opinion, if you want to take one symbol of humility, the best is prostration. That's the best symbol of humility in front of God. It is perhaps the greatest symbol of submission. Why? The person puts the highest point of his body, his forehead, on the ground to make a symbolic statement. O Lord, I have submitted. O Lord, I have submitted. Imam Riza, the 8th saint of the Shi'i tradition, probably said it the best, and I quote, "The nearest state to God is in prostration. The nearest state to God is prostration," which I believe it is true. But there is a caveat, though. What is the caveat? I think this Persian mystic poetry explains the best what this caveat is in prostration. This is what we really aim to do when we prostrate. گیرم که هزار مصحف از برداری آن را چه کنی که نفس کافر داری سر را به زمین چمینهی وقت نماز آن را به زمین بنه که در سر داری. Suppose you have memorized 1,000 holy books. What do you do with the infidel in yourself? When you put your head on the ground in prayer, put on the ground what is inside your head. That's what we need to be doing when we prostrate. We need to put on the ground what is inside our head. All of those illusions that we have, all of those inaccurate misperceptions that we have about our invincibility, about our perfection. This is what we are supposed to be putting on the ground. We need to shatter this illusion that other idols and other folks can deliver us. That's basically the symbolic meaning of prostration. I know I went over time by at least 10-15 minutes, and I apologize if I talk too much, and I hope that this lecture on the role of daily prayers in all religious traditions were of some value to you, and I hope to see you in a future visit to Fresno. Thank you very much, and God bless you all.